from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we continue our special report, taking a closer look at the uprising in Baltimore, past and present, and uprisings elsewhere. Protests continue in the aftermath of the unrest in Baltimore. Wednesday saw at least 150 people arrested in fresh rallies across the U.S., with more than 120 people arrested in New York alone, where thousands gathered to demonstrate over the death of Freddie Gray. Press TV's Caleb Maupin was in New York and filed this report.
The north end of New York City's historic Union Square was packed with thousands of people who were gathered to express solidarity with the youth of Baltimore. Before the rally had even begun, protesters were handed leaflets by the New York City police threatening them with arrest if they entered the streets. Hundreds of police surrounded the square, and a recorded message threatening arrest was broadcasted over speakers. Veteran civil rights activist Larry Holmes was disgusted by the actions of the police.
This is not only totally unnecessary, it's actually offensive. It's offensive to the victims of police terror. It's an insult to everyone who came out here on short notice to stand with Baltimore.
When protesters began to march out of the square, they were met by a line of police officers in riot gear who aggressively pushed the crowd back. Police charged into the crowd waving their batons, and many protesters were arrested. After a lengthy clash on 17th Street near the north end of the square, some of the protesters were able to escape the square from its southern end. Protesters, packed onto the sidewalk, expressed rage at the police as many were dragged away in handcuffs. Protesters expect the actions of the NYPD only to inflame the rising anger across the country.
These young, brave people, they're neither stupid, they're not thugs, they're not criminals. To my mind, they're heroes, and I'm very proud of them. The thugs, the criminals, or this armed gang of thugs called the police, who go around killing and beating up and jailing black and brown people with impunity. These are the gangs of thugs that we should be talking about and doing something about.
Some of the protesters linked the rising unrest to underlying economic conditions. Many expressed frustration with mainstream U.S. media.
I wish that there was a different voice speaking outside of mainstream media because I don't feel like we're getting the full story of things.
Confrontations went on for the rest of the evening and into the night. The protest in New York City was just one of many massive demonstrations taking place across the United States in support of the youth in Baltimore. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
More arrests were reported in the Big Apple after protesters stopped traffic on Houston Street in Lower Manhattan, and others blocked the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. Still others were arrested as they marched uptown to Times Square and beyond. Arrests were also reported in Washington, Denver, and Boston. Meanwhile, protesters in Baltimore defied the nighttime curfew, which was imposed Tuesday. Baltimore's mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, said the nightly curfew will remain in place and be assessed on a daily basis. Mayor Rawlings Blake herself was under attack for comments she made earlier when she said police were instructed to not interfere with people causing property damage.
I've made it very clear that I worked with the police and instructed them to do everything that they could to make sure that the protesters were able to exercise their right to free speech. It's a very delicate balancing act because while we try to make sure that they were protected from the cars and the other things that were going on, we also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well. And we worked very hard to keep that balance and to put ourselves in the best position to de-escalate, and that's what you saw this evening.
But it was in 1968, under then-Republican governor and soon-to-be Vice President Spiro T. Agnew, that the state's highest military officer, General George Gelson, gave an even more detailed response when he faced similar criticism from a reporter.
General, there has been some criticism about the way the forces at your command handled the looting here. It's been suggested that force should have been met with force.
I can just say that I wish the decision was as simple to me as it is to those people who would not be required to live by their decision. There are a number of factors involved when you come to considering force that I think perhaps people forget. And the first one is the value of life. What value do you attach to life? Is a loaf of bread or a pint of whiskey or a scorched suit or a pair of shoes worth a life? Now, I have 11,000 troops deployed in this city. And it would be up to each one of those individuals to make that decision. And I submit that this is a decision that even the wisest man would have difficulty in making under tense circumstances. Another thing is, we know from experience that when there is firing and indiscriminate firing, that more innocent people have been killed than have the guilty ones.
Media demonization of the victim, gross evidence tampering, and an overall dual standard of justice taint the process when police killings come to the attention of the public. So says veteran human rights lawyer Michael Tarif Warren, whose deep experience as an attorney in such cases includes his representation and the ultimate exoneration of three of the wrongfully convicted men known as the Central Park Five. He spoke with CPR's Bernard White about the case in Baltimore and the legal and political treatment of cases involving police killings via telephone Thursday.
One of the things that I have been talking about is how, as soon as something like this happens, the police cover-up mechanism goes directly into effect. And they begin to throw a bunch of stuff in the game so that they can use later on to justify why they are not going to pursue justice in these cases. Have you seen that happening in this particular case with Freddie Gray?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, first of all, no one has dealt with the legal issue of the lack of a legal basis for the stop of Freddie Gray in the first place. The legal standard is whether, in fact, there is a reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot, as we lawyers like to say, who deal in these type of cases. And based on my understanding of the facts, the basis for this, for the pursuit, which ultimately led to the stop, was the allegation that Freddie Gray stared at these police officers, and after the stare, they engaged in a pursuit after he began to run. That is not a legal basis for stop. That is not a legal basis for declaring that reasonable suspicion of criminal activity is afoot. And since there was no legal basis for the stop, there was no probable cause for the arrest. And there certainly was not there was no basis for the for what occurred thereafter. And now I know that the video does not capture everything. The video that I've seen, and I think that most people have seen on the in the media, but it does show him being handcuffed. And one thing I've noticed in particular is that his head is sort of leaning over, almost hanging over to the left side. And there seems to be an inability to walk on his own, maybe because his legs were dragging, which means that there is certainly an inference that at that stage that he may have been incapacitated substantially as a result of whatever they did to him, which was not revealed on the video. But I think that more outrageous is the recent revelations that have come about, where I think it's reported in today's Washington Post, and I haven't read the article, but that the person who was in the back of the police van with him is supposedly saying that he did certain things to himself, and it's not really clear at this point, but I think that the legal basis for him being stopped and you're right. You know, the mechanism for covering up swings into effect right away. I mean, instantly. I mean, and I've been doing these cases for years, back since 1983. And normally what appears at the forefront is the criminalization process, where they seize upon if a victim has a prior criminal record of any sorts, they seize upon that in terms of making that known to the public for purposes of criminalizing that person, as if that is a legitimate basis for what happened to that person, and legally sanctions what happens to that person. But they seize upon it for purposes of putting it out there in the public, so in an attempt to criminalize that person and create less of a favorable attitude among the public for what happened to that person. So the victim becomes, in that process, the criminal, and the criminals who committed the criminal acts, the police officers, become the legal agents for doing so, and when their actions are sanctioned, and in some instances they become the victims themselves. So, but what in this particular case, we haven't had that, you know, and the reason we haven't had that, because if he had a criminal record, that's something that would have been put out there. And so, you know, I think that these are really some real concerns. And also, in the case of a death, you never, ever, ever trust the city medical examiner's opinion as to the cause of death. Now, we know that the cause of death indicates that his spine was broken, and et cetera, and that caused the death. But there may be other factors that are far more significant in terms of pinpointing specifically what happened to him, other than the assertion that his spine was broken. And that's why people, families who have relatives, you know, who succumb to these type of experiences, have to immediately hire their own pathologist for purposes of conducting a second autopsy to go over what the medical examiner did to determine whether, in fact, anything that the medical examiner did was appropriate or inappropriate, or whether they simply failed to observe or do certain things that should have been done to bring out more facts about what caused the death and what the other factors may have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've seen where medical examiners, in the case where police strangled a young man, had taken the eyes and rinsed him, and the eyes would be one of the places that would show that the suspect was, that the victim was asphyxiated. So we always got to be careful about the city's medical.
Oh, sure, yeah, that was a case that, in fact, that was the very first case that back in 1983, as you may recall, Bernard, that I was involved in, along with Lewis Clayton Jones and Elton Maddox, and that was a Michael Stewart case in which Dr. Gross placed his eyes in a after they were extracted into a bleaching solution for purposes of bleaching out, attempting to bleach out the existence of particular hemorrhaging, which clearly revealed that he was strangled. And had that bleaching solution, had he not been caught by the pathologist for the family that we hired right away, then the public would never have known that the hemorrhages existed that served as a basis for indicating that he was strangled.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that they're asking for right now, and they've made it public, is that they're asking for the police officers, for one of the police officers, the arresting police officer's uniform, because they want to check to see if there's any DNA on the uniform. And that's confusing to me. I don't understand what the significance of that is. Do you have any idea?
Well, I certainly don't understand, you know, where they're going on that. I mean, and I certainly don't think that they need a warrant. That they need a warrant approved to seize that police officer's uniform. That officer has an obligation to provide that uniform if, in fact, there's a reasonable belief that there is some value in terms of aiding the so-called investigation that's been going on. But to answer your question, I don't know what whether they would want to have do a DNA analysis. I just don't know what that's about. You know, I'd have to have much more of a context to understand the significance of such a request, such an application. I think that what's appalling is for them to say that, and this is my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, but for them to say that they need to get a search warrant signed by a judge, for purposes of securing that uniform. And the fact is that here it is almost a week and a half, at least a week and a half after, maybe 2 weeks after the incident occurred, and such attempts are being made. I'm sure that if there was any value in whatever is suspected that may aid the investigation, as far as that uniform is concerned, that value has been totally eliminated, because I would imagine that the uniform has been modified or has been cleansed in such a way that there is no real value in whatever they may have been seeking. But I think that what concerns me is one of the things concerning me, things concern me about this case, but one of the things that concerns me is the fact that now the so-called fact finding, first of all, the police officers are investigating themselves. I mean, and that's unheard of. Because it's like the Fox, covering the tracks of another fox who raided the chicken coop and trying to determine whether that was appropriate or inappropriate, legal or not legal. So that's something that should have been objected to in the strongest sense by folks who are in a leadership capacity in Baltimore that are connected with this case. The other thing is that the state's attorney's office, as you know, Bernard, the district attorneys, they would call them state's attorneys down in Maryland, but they fill the same purpose. They have such a close symbiotic relationship with the police on a daily basis that there's no way in the world that they could conduct a fair and impartial investigation into what happened here. And that's been demonstrated in many different situations, historically, in many cases that have occurred. And I don't even know if the Justice Department could conduct a proper investigation here. But certainly the local district attorney's office or the state's attorney's office could not. And so this case should have been handed over to a special prosecutor who has a substantial semblance of impartiality long ago for purposes of conducting an investigation that had some degree of integrity to it. But from them now to say that tomorrow the police findings will be handed over to the state's attorney's office and that this matter may not be resolved for weeks, if not months, I mean, is absurd. I mean, you refer to those who were outraged, not only because of what happened to Freddie Gray, and I'm talking about the young people as well as the older people, but in terms of the young people whom they have referred to as folks, but you tell them not to be outraged. You tell them to be orderly. You tell them, to just hold on, to just wait, as they've told our people many, many, many times in different historical contexts and different factual situations over the years. When they are deeply, I firmly believe, involved in attempting to legitimatize what these officers did and how they handled this case. And I frankly don't see that at the end of the road there's going to be any action taken against these officers not even any administrative actions within their own departments. And I certainly don't think that any of them will be arrested and charged with a crime for what happened to Freddie Gray. So if in fact that becomes the case, and the beat goes on, and so what is really upsetting is that they have shifted the focus on what they have perceived to be the criminality and the inappropriateness of the actions of these, in my opinion, these young, courageous young people who have been out there in the streets and totally ignored, are not focused on the real legal issues in this case that I've just discussed, and that's appalling. Mm-hmm.
And we're talking to Michael, defense attorney Michael Tarif Warren, about what's taking place in Baltimore. You know, today, Friday, one of the things that that might lead to some additional street activity is that we were told or led to believe that there was going to be a report coming out of the medical examiner's office as it relates to the autopsy. And now we hear that that report is not going to come. So people are anticipating that there's going to be some kind of information coming to them today. And I think that they're going to be disappointed, and it's going to lead to additional street activities. How long does it take to do an autopsy?
I've been in a number of autopsies for in cases where police have killed individuals whose families we represented. But a complete autopsy would take, and I'm talking about the gross anatomical procedure or the gross autopsy, would only take about, I would say at the most, a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, particularly in a case like this. And then there is a further toxicological study which during the gross autopsy procedure, certain organs are severed, pieces of organs are severed for purposes of submitting. I've been putting to on blocks and also putting into solutions for preserving them for purposes of what is called a toxicological study. And that toxicological study takes place over a period of weeks. Sometimes it's accelerated depending on the importance of having an accelerated toxicological finding. In this case, I think it would be, if there's any value in the toxicological study, I'm not sure that there would be any real value, but there might be. It should be accelerated as quickly as possible. But the medical examiner's report is only a part of the overall findings by the police investigation, as I understand it. You know, the police conduct an investigation into what happened, and part of that, those findings that ultimately are made by a department includes the gross anatomical study or the gross autopsy procedure, and which may say is subject to further final determination based on further study, toxicological studies. And I would think that given the importance of this case, at least the gross findings should be available as inclusive of the overall findings in the police that the police have prepared. It's my understanding that those findings are being turned over to the state's attorney, who's a young woman. I mean, when I say young, she's young in the office. And even though she was a prior assistant state's attorney, she has just become was sworn in as state's attorney for Baltimore County, as I understand it, in January of this year. So she doesn't really have the overall experience, although I'm sure she has some understanding in terms of how what takes place and what should take place in a case like this, but it's been turned over to her. And again, it's the concern that I have, you know, if that is a concern, her recent appointment and the lack of involvement in a case like this of such a magnitude is the symbiotic relationship. That's the other concern I have. And the fact that she would not be, her office would not be able to conduct a fair and impartial investigation. But to have, to findings are going to be turned over to her office and for further action, which may take months, is a complete misrepresentation in terms of the representations that were being made during the initial stages of this case when the young brothers and sisters were out there in the street raising hell. So now that the National Guard and the state police and other law enforcement agencies from other jurisdictions have come in, there now seems to be a different twist, and we have things under control, so we don't have to be as quick in terms of providing definitive answers as to what happened to Freddie Gray that we represented that we would be engaged in earlier in the case. And I just want to say one thing further, that another thing that's appalling is that, as you know, Bernard, you know, if you're arrested, for example, my wife and I, we were arrested, even though we were attorneys and whatnot, we were arrested for attempting to quell the vicious beating of a young man by the police in Brooklyn back in 2007. And as you correctly mentioned, the community amply came to our assistance, and they stormed the precinct in hundreds. But not for that, we would have been run through the system immediately. You know, and the question becomes, why aren't these cops run through the system immediately and arrested just as any other person would be, and their cases, you know, brought before a grand jury for preliminary hearing, however they do it down in Maryland, for purposes of determining whether in fact there is enough for an indictment. So there's a whole question of disparate treatment in terms of how the public, the general public, is treated when there is a suspicion of criminality based on whatever may have taken place, and how the police are treated. The police are given deference, almost complete deference, and which is why they are in many instances no charges are brought. And in Maryland, even more egregious than in New York City. In New York City, there's a 48-hour rule in which the police don't have to talk to anybody who are suspected of being engaged in activities that are similar to what happened to Freddie Gray. But in Maryland, they've got 10 days to get their stories and their acts together, a substantially much longer period of time. So it becomes a charade, a diabolical charade. And instead of those people, and I'm talking about, you know, I have to name any names. We all know who's been out there trying to quell the community, and then there's some sense in that, you know. But let's talk about the real issues. You know, let's talk about the institutions, you know, that have historically come together for purposes of covering up these acts of criminality and these summary executions that have been engaged in by the police departments all over the country for many, many years.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us today, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again in the future. This, you know, what you were saying about the amount of time that the police have to get their story together, that seems to be a byproduct of police unions. That seems to be one of the things that they, if not negotiate, strong arm their way into making sure that that the police officers, when they are involved in these excesses, don't have to come clean until they get an opportunity to come up with some kind of alibi.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. Absolutely.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.